You're listening to a Cripple and Co. production.
Welcome to A.G. Parker's Cabinet of Curiosities, an inclusive podcast focused on queer, disabled, and marginalized creatives and their art. If you can afford to help me keep the podcast going and help me get the transcription service in place, please sign up to my Patreon for as little as £1 a month on patreon.com/agparker. You can also buy me a coffee on Buy Me a Coffee, which you can find on my link tree. And now, on with the show. Today on the podcast, we've got Himish Macbeth. Himish is a disabled drag performer from the Kingdom of Fife in Scotland. With a background in stage acting, he's been using drag as a medium since 2022, coming up through the Scottish Shut Up and King support network. He's a raconteur and provocateur and a fierce believer in disabled pride and disabled joy. The elbow crutches he relies on to get around are also a source of creativity and joyful movement. Think acrobatic tricks, not apologetic sticks. A little bit him, a little bit ish. Macbeth is half punk rebel, half pure camp silliness with a heart of gold. Himish, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Hi, so much. Thanks so much for having me.
I'm so excited to have you here. This is a real honour. So thank you.
Thank you.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing all right. Yeah, I'm cold, but
it's that time of year to be cozied up listening to a podcast.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So for anyone that hasn't seen you perform, either online or in person, tell us a little bit about what you do.
I try and do lots of different things. And that's kind of part of why I like a drag performance particularly, is because it kind of gives you the opportunity within kind of one persona, as it were, to kind of try and do different kinds of things. So I do political acts, and I do some spoken word that goes into kind of queer history and that kind of thing. And I do, you know, some traditional, if that's what you want to call it, kind of lip syncs that are just camp and silly and fun, because I think that's also really important. You know, as you said in the intro there, I do use elbow crutches to get around. I've got a complex regional pain syndrome. So obviously they are always part of me, because mobility aids are, is something I have to use all the time. And so they, incorporate those in my acts as well, because it's really important that they're not just kind of like tacked on as a little apology.
Yeah.
And they do actually, you know, I could use them in the same way as I would use my arms or legs or other parts of my body.
And it looks absolutely fabulous. I'm so keen to see you perform live, because all I've seen so far has been on social media, because I don't get out much. But it really does make a difference seeing somebody else using mobility aids in performance. And as you say, in such a joyful way as well. Have you found quite a lot of people have come up to you and asked you questions about it afterwards? Has it inspired conversation?
Yeah, I find, people kind of ask about gigs and kind of and that kind of thing. But I think what is great is actually social media. And, you know, I'll post up something on Instagram and get messages from other drag performers and kind of various other people who kind of use mobility aids and go, oh, that's, you know, I've not seen a message like that last week saying I haven't seen anyone else like just doing that on stage. And it's that whole thing about visibility, isn't it? It's like, oh, if people are doing it, and that's not an odd thing to do, and that's not, you know, that's a way to be creative and to move about. And it's lovely when I kind of get messages like that. And
it's incredible. And for me as well, as somebody who, because I think I've had my stick called a prop a couple of times, and it's so the more people that are out there using crutches or using walking sticks or other mobility aids on stage, I think the better, because then maybe people won't kind of assume it's like a bit. I don't know what kind of bit I would be doing.
And I think it's one of the reasons it's important that people don't do that. If, you know, it's mobility aids and all of that kind of thing, it's something that some people need. And I think it's really important not to appropriate that. Because then, you know, then you don't know what the line is. And then,
I was going to ask you about that, what your opinion is, because there was recently a drag king, and I probably won't name them, who was seen using a walking stick in one of their acts. And I know somebody reached out to them to have a conversation, explain why we don't want people to do that. What's your take?
Yeah, and I think if it's the one I'm thinking of, I think you reacted really positively, which is fantastic. Yeah. I think people react in different ways to being called out on that, and it's really interesting. I'm never sure. You know, I have had conversations with people, and I've had, you know, more times when I've just left it because I can't be bothered. I can't do that conversation again, you know.
Yeah.
And I know some people who call it out more, and that I think that's amazing. Good on them. I think what I have done is just sort of generally shared resources about kind of making drag more accessible. And I think sometimes people do feel like you're personally calling them out, even when you're not. It's just like, this is an endemic problem. It's like racism, it's like all of it. You know, we live in a really ableist world, and it's a case of helping people catch some of the things that they do that they don't know are ableist and haven't really thought about. And I think, you know, like I think in that example that you said, the person kind of then posted up saying, listen, I didn't know about this, and so thanks for educating me, and you know, now I know.
Which is the best response we could ever hope for.
Yeah. And I think people, you know, can get defensive about it and will think that, you know, you're getting at them personally, whereas it's really not. I mean, it's not that I would not speak to someone again or not, you know. I just, sometimes it's good to say, you know, do you know that that's upsetting for a group of people?
Yeah.
Do you know that you're upsetting people by doing that? And I think at that point you can say, that's where I kind of, I will say to someone, you know, that is upsetting. This is why. I can send you some links, whatever. I'm not going to debate it.
Yeah.
Because if you're going to tell me that it's not upsetting, then that's a useless conversation. I think it is about what people do next. And accessibility is a hard one because, you know, venues, for example, is a big, you know, I will advocate that venues are as accessible as possible. Mm. And that means in terms of, you know, being sort of wheelchair accessible for acts and performers, and but also, you know, in terms of noise levels, in terms of, you know, no flashing lights, you know, really for show to be fully accessible, it should be live streamed to online as well. You know, I will advocate for all of that, but I don't expect all of that when I go to a show, and I am a realist, and you know, trying to find a venue when you've got putting on a little like shoestring budget grassroots show, you do have to make compromises. And I think sometimes people think, oh, you know, I'm really sorry the venue's not that accessible. It's like, I'm not the accessibility police. I will share things, and I will educate people, and I will help, and I will you know, advocate to, you know, to councils and governments and that kind of thing as well, to kind of to make venues more accessible. But I'm not gonna kind of get personally upset at a producer because their show was down some stairs because that's the only venue that they could get.
Yeah.
And I think it's you know, it's difficult. And I think you know, we're all, it's the world that we live in is set up like that. And I think if we can just all exist in a spirit where we can point things out to people, and it's not seen as like calling out or a criticism, or it's just like, oh, did you know, you know, like, did you know your shoelace is untied? Or did you know, it's just like, did you know that that's the thing that you're
exactly.
doing?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's the, I'm not going to say the right attitude, that's the wrong way. I think that's exactly the attitude that's going to help us find progress and find movement, and hopefully improve issues like accessibility or making spaces more inclusive. It is that defensive attitude, though. As soon as you come up against a defensive attitude, that's way worse than, you know, a set of stairs or not having a ramp for a venue.
Yeah.
Because then, you know, you can't actually take it anywhere. So it's, yeah, it is.
Yeah, it's better to kind of say, this is where our issues are. And we understand that, and this is why we've had to do it this certain way, than to kind of say, no, it's fine. I'm, you know, stop getting at me. And, you know, so it's, yeah. It's difficult.
It absolutely is. I had a friend reach out to me the other day and say she was doing a course and the course didn't have the best accessibility, although it was kind of saying like, we aim to be accessible, so just reach out and get in touch. And I think she'd got in touch and they still kind of didn't do the thing. And she got so, it was one of those days, she got so angry, she got so overwhelmed, and she's like, they should just know, I shouldn't have to educate them, and I shouldn't have to educate every single venue or space that I go into. They should just know.
Yeah.
Which would be wonderful, but then who is going to give that training? Because it shouldn't be.
Well, I think in the case of if you're doing a course, if you're doing something that's provided in that level, then I agree. Actually, I think they should know. And there are people out there that can do that training. Again, it kind of comes back down to that kind of government level as well, of sometimes, you know, that you should just have to, but it is exhausting having to educate people all the time, and having to choose where you do and choose where you kind of go, well, this is awful, but I can't be bothered. That it's already caused me so many kind of expenditure and spoons and kind of whatever that is to navigate this. I can't then complain about it, or can't then try and educate people about it, because I've used up all my energy on navigating it. And so I think the interesting thing to know is that when people do have things pointed out like that, and they might kind of say, oh, only a couple of people have said anything. It's like, well, yeah, but for every one person that has got it up to actually say something, there's like at least 10 more who have just gone, oh, I'm just going to leave it. I'm just going to leave it. I'll be bothered today.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. That's it. And I think it should be like, if you hit 5, then you should pay somebody who is disabled to teach you how to do better. I don't know, maybe just pay someone who's disabled to educate you in the first place. But so in terms of the fight for disability justice, you say in your wonderful Google form, thank you so much for returning it, you are wonderful, that often people kind of have this attitude of, yeah, we'll help you because one day that might be us, or maybe that's how the disability community kind of sells it, is one day you'll be disabled, so you should fight for accessibility now. But then you also say, but yeah, we should just do it because it's the right thing.
Yeah, it's one of those things that I have this complicated relationship with, because pretty much, yes, you know, if you are lucky to live a long life, you will have some kind of disability within that long life. And so, yes, the kind of this will be you one day. But that's, I just don't think that's why you should do it.
Yeah,
because, you know, you don't try and work to be anti-racist, because you know I'm always going to be white, I'm never going to be I'm always going to be white, but that's, you know, but I fight against racism because racism is wrong. Like that, and that should be enough with ableism. Like it's wrong, it's upsetting for people, and like that should be enough. You know, people kind of talk about the business case for accessibility as well, and it's like, oh, you know, it'll be good business. It's like, well, I mean, yeah, but again,
I feel like we find all these ways of saying, please like have our cause in your heart, whereas really, it should just be like automatic, rather than you might make some money or it could be you someday. Do we
have, but it probably will be, you know. It's,
do we have a solution to how we can make people care just because it's the right thing to do?
I think visibility helps.
Yeah.
I think, you know, you can think about, you're lighting the show and someone can say to you, oh, well, you know, if we had an epileptic person in, that flashlighting is going to upset them.
Yeah.
But if you say, that performer standing over there on the stage right now has epilepsy, and if you put that light on, they're going to collapse. Mm. That's kind of, it's a bit more like, oh, I see that actual human being that has an effect. And now I understand that. And of course I will.
Yeah. And the
and so, or, you know, whatever it is, kind of wheelchair users, or, you know, not all accessibility is about mobility. And so I make sure it's not, and that's not always the focus of it. But Yeah, I think visibility is probably the biggest thing that helps. But visibility is essentially disabled people doing the education and doing the work of helping raise the awareness. I don't think there's a way around that. I think, as you say, where there's a paid role, I think, you know, making sure that disabled people get, you know, if there's a opportunity to be paid for that advice, then, you know, you should absolutely have that. But yeah, I think that's probably the, I say not the solution, I don't think it was, but, you know, a powerful solution.
Absolutely. Certainly. Yeah. Visibility and representation. That's kind of where I keep landing on.
Yeah.
Has the biggest impact. And I've seen recently, or I've made it up, I'm not entirely sure. I've had migraines, but I've seen recently that I think there's going to be a wheelchair user on some kind of dancing show. Is it Strictly Come Dancing or Dancing with the Stars or something?
Oh, okay. I don't watch reality TV I'm kind of quite bad for certain types of drag that I'm not up with, like modern culture and things at all. But that's fantastic. I know they had someone on last year, didn't they?
No, I also don't know because I also don't watch much reality TV. but it's great for everybody else. And it's brilliant for the disability community in terms of representation, especially I think representation and visibility when it comes to entertainment. It's all about the spoonful of sugar. So many people won't tune in if it's a disability focused show that's teaching people about ableism and accessibility, but they will watch, you know, somebody dancing on ice, or maybe not on ice, you know, whatever it is.
No, I know what you mean, and I've had kind of times like that where I've thought, you know, this maybe been, you know, a choice about where I spend my spoons. And if I've got a gig, I'm like, you know what? I'm going to spend my spoons on being good and going there and entertaining people so that it's not seen of like, oh, yeah, we had a disabled person on. Yeah. It's like, we had a really good performer on.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're disabled. And I don't, it's difficult, right? Because I think I'm going to go on a tangent now.
I love to have tangents. Do it. Yeah.
because I have seen a kind of few things about, oh, you know, groups of people that are just not very good in various kind of ways. And I think everyone has to be not good. And I'm not saying I'm brilliant now at all. I'm better than I was when I started. And hopefully that is true for, you know, everyone. But you have to allow people to not be good for a bit.
Yeah.
And you need to have show bookers and whatnot that do take a chance on people and do maybe take a couple of chances with people, even if they weren't great the first time, because they will have learned from that. If you never give new people, and I don't just mean disabled people in this, you know, I'm talking about, you know, any group or any kind of individual, that, you know, they need to be able to go out and be bad for a bit, and especially if they're doing something new and exciting and trying something and going, well, you know, I took a risk there. Yeah. And it didn't work. But I'd rather see someone, as like an audience member, I'd rather see someone take a risk that doesn't work than just not take a risk and give me like 100%. What I've seen 500 times.
I would rather see something ambitious go badly than, and I'm not dissing lip syncs, but you know, if it's just another lip sync.
Yeah.
I'd rather see some ambitious, weird kind of like, I don't know, you're throwing clay during a performance, like something a bit out there.
Yeah. Always one of the producers if you're going to throw clay.
All the many.
But yeah, and I think it's the thing with like with disabled people, I think what sometimes happens is, you know, you kind of go out and you have to try, and as with everyone else, kind of your first few performances is not great. People somehow notice that more with certain groups.
Yeah.
And then they don't get booked, and then they get kind of, you're dealing with the ableism, and then it just gets exhausting, and then people quit, and then people go, oh, well, there aren't any disabled performers. And you go, well, yes, because you kind of push them out. Not you, again, like not you individually. I'm not getting at you individually necessarily. I mean, obviously there are individuals but it's a problem. You know, this scene, it wasn't welcoming enough to them. And didn't allow them to make a couple of mistakes, and didn't allow them to be who they were. And so they've left. And so that's why there aren't any. And then it's a perpetuating kind of circle.
Yeah. It's the same with any kind of marginalized group, take women, right? Yeah. Like women in virtually any kind of sphere doing literally anything, they deserve the right to do as badly as men. And, you know, proper inclusion and equality, this is what I'm trying to say, proper inclusion and equality means that we can go out and do some shit work.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. I want to be bad, because then I know that if I keep trying, I will eventually be good and I'll improve.
Yeah, like I actually worked in comedy for years, and I mean, I'm kind of performing, but also kind of producing and whatnot. And it was, you know, the whole kind of thing about women comedians not being as good is just that as soon as you see a bad woman comedian, people are like, oh, well, that's because women comedians aren't good. Yeah. And then so the women have to do better, and so they're more stressed to do better. And then if they don't, it's like, oh, well, see. And then, yeah, it's... And then they quit. And then there are no women comedians. It's the same. Yeah, it's, you're absolutely right. It's the same with kind of any marginalized group. And I'm sure the people of color have this very, yeah, very similar kind of pattern and, you know, various kind of different groups. And it's...
yeah, the standards are higher. And if you don't hit those standards, then you're out.
Yeah.
which is a ridiculous amount of pressure to put people under.
Yeah.
Speaking of standards and pressure and wibbly wobbly things going up and down. Because this is one of the points on your form, and because this is currently something that I'm going through, which is quite interesting, I've used my stick once in the last 2 months, which is very unusual. I'm doing a lot better for whatever reason. We don't really know why. And I'm currently putting together a set for something new in a couple of months' time. And I don't know whether to choreograph using my walking stick, which would be like my normal kind of inclination, or to not. And then I have this fear of people are going to see me with a walking stick for some numbers and without a walking stick for others, or some days I'll be using it, some days I won't. And so what's your thought on disability kind of being dynamic?
This is kind of one of my catchphrases, is that it's not, disability is not consistent or linear. I know I did kind of mention earlier that, you know, the crutches are always part of me, and I pretty much do always use them. I also have a wheelchair that I sometimes use, which again, I think to an even larger extent, you know, as soon as you use a wheelchair and then you stand up, it's like, you know, well, you must be kind of a faker, yeah, and all of that kind of thing. But I mean, the human body isn't linear. And I think non-disabled people, if they really think about it, you know, some days they can do things and sometimes they can't. And when I think that's sort of amplified in all directions by, depending obviously on what disability you have, but with something like me, who, you know, it's a chronic pain condition, it's better some days and it's worse some days. And that is something that I think is important, again, you know, in terms of educating people about disability, that I think that's something that's really important for people to understand, that it doesn't mean that you're faking it one day, or, you know, I mean, like I can go on stage and I can dance using my crutches, and I can,
and you like, can I'm like still really, you can really throw yourself around from what I've seen. Like it's,
yeah, I can generally. And, you know, I can do that for, you know, a 3 minute act. but that doesn't mean that I can have that kind of level, you know, like you wouldn't say to a drag queen, oh, well, I can see you do a death drop there, so you need to do 5 of those in order to kind of make your own breakfast. Is that all right? They'd be like, well, no, hang on. I could do it sometimes. I could do it, but, and it's, you know, it's that same kind of thing. I do worry, I think, when I go on stage and I'm fairly mobile, particularly kind of with the way that I dance around, like I know that I'm not putting weight a certain way, and I know that I'm not doing a certain thing, but that's not necessarily obvious unless you're looking out for it in the choreography. And so I guess it's the flip side of kind of being pleased to be visible, is like, that are people going to think that I'm faking it? Because people, that's an accusation that so many disabled people get.
Yeah, you're visible and you're now being policed, so congratulations.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm not that, I've seen, no one has said that to me specifically, but I know that it goes on, and so I know that. Yeah,
but then as you say, the more people kind of see, And I speak about it quite openly. Like the last show I did, I think I said, like, and this is the first time I've ever done a number without my walking stick, and I'm going to give it a go. And I had a chair to support me, and I had like some moves built in, which I knew would kind of rest my body or give me a chance to not strain stuff.
I think it's a case of where you put your personal challenges and things, isn't it? Because I think, you know, another side of that is that, you know, if you need a mobility aid, you should have a mobility aid. And I think sometimes people think they need to like pass some kind of test or have some kind of diagnosis or, you know, have a like a level of disability, which is not a thing. I'm disabled 0.5. You know, it's not, if something is helping you, then it should be helping you. And I think the more people actually accept that across society, the more they'll kind of realize that therefore someone else maybe with a mobility aid, yes, needs it today but might not need it tomorrow, or yes, can do that on stage for 3.5 minutes but no, can't do that for the rest of the night, and possibly can't do that for the rest of the night because they've just done that on stage for 3 minutes.
Exactly.
You know, and you know, I had a friend of mine's mum who kind of said, oh, I've finally given in and got myself a mobility scooter after 40 years, and I just almost cried. I said, like, why didn't you do this 40 years ago? Why have you been suffering for 40 years?
Yeah.
Because it's seen as, and that's the thing, is the disability seen as a weakness. And obviously, you know, it's in some ways, like I have a weak leg, like that's, but that's not giving into, it's not something I give into. It's just it's the way that I am and the way that I exist. And it's not, there's no moral, there's no kind of, it's morally neutral whether you're disabled or not. It's not, you know, on how you cope with being disabled and how you, you know,
yeah,
I mean, cope with how you navigate being disabled. It's, yeah,
yeah.
It's,
the linking of morality to disability is one of the things that it makes my blood boil. I think I did an episode with Charlotte Lunn where we discussed this. Maybe I've probably talked about it quite a few times because it's something that you come up against in so many different aspects of life. Like obviously anybody who's involved with the church might have experienced it more. I know people that I was close to who were very religious kind of said like, oh, have you considered what sin you might need to repent for in order to heal? Oh, that was it. I did an episode with Mugabe where we spoke about this because he kept getting people praying for him, and it was yeah, it's wild that we have that link. And also I'm very sad about your friend's mum, because I know when I'm giving my body what it needs and the support it needs and not fighting against my disability, I'm so much healthier and actually able to do more.
Yeah, and happier and less stressed.
Oh, God,
and,
yeah. You know,
often stress is bad for pain. So actually it's kind of, it helps on multiple levels.
Yeah. So ironically, so, like the one time I've had to use my stick in 2 months is because I was going out to do a book launch, and my body at the first sign of stress is like, cool, we're going to shut down, give you a migraine and make your left side stop working. So I think while a lot of the time I might not be horrendously disabled, and I say that because I have like 2 hours of activity during the day and then a lot of naps, but as soon as I have to go out and get on stage and the kind of the tiring things that are around performing, I know that that's going to make me appear more disabled. That's this.
Yeah. Do you know what though, it's interesting, like you kind of, I think what you said just there kind of sounds like what I will say sometimes about, you know, so there isn't kind of a level of disability. Yes, there are people who have more struggles on a day-to-day basis than others. But, you know, I have times when I go, oh, maybe I am like faking. Like maybe, like you start to kind of that internalize ableism of like, maybe I'm just making this up. Maybe it's, you know, because actually I just, you know, I stood and I did the washing up for 5 minutes, you know, and there are times when I couldn't have done that. So maybe I was lying that times when I thought I couldn't. Maybe the fact that I've been able to do an hour of activity means that I'm not, and then you kind of, you logic out aloud and going, well, you know, I can't walk kind of up the stairs without a stick, or I can't walk, but you know, I'm either not as bad as I was before, I'm not as bad as someone else or whatever. Yeah. And so therefore, you know, maybe I'm not really disabled. And, you know, I get this quite a lot because I've got, you know, a good friend in in the drag world who kind of uses a wheelchair. And I think, well, but I only use sticks and sometimes in the house, like I often don't use sticks. And so maybe, you know, like maybe I'm a faker, yeah, or maybe, you know, right. You kind of think, well, what? Like, no, that's, you know, yeah. That there's a million different types of disability. And even, you know, even within talking about mobility issues, there's lots of, and then, you know, you've got a million others. I mean, the way that I always describe myself as being queer, disabled and neurodivergent, because neurodivergence can be considered disability, but I often separate them out because I'm physically disabled and neurodivergent. Yeah. But the fact is that that is also a disability and it's all part of the same community. And I think if we can support each other and learn from each other and understand each other's needs, then that's much better than thinking, oh, maybe I don't belong because I'm not like as disabled as someone else. And what grade have I got of my disability today? You know, it's
well, and like, does that grade like change within 5 minutes over the course of the day or like week to week? Or like, I mean, you could tie yourself up in knots trying to think that through.
I know I
get imposter syndrome and internalized ableism quite a lot. My partner, bless him, there's been two times within our relationship where my health has been so stable that I've gone, I'm going to call the DWP and tell them I don't need benefits anymore. And he's like, it's been a week. Sit the fuck down. Like, let's revisit this next week. And then literally like the next day, yeah, I'll be like unable to dress myself or feed myself. And he's like, Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the thing. And I think, you know, the DWP and whatever kind of systems that I've got a lot to answer for, because it is where you kind of, it is almost like that's where you have an official form, and that's where, you know, you have to kind of, like, you never go to the doctor and kind of go, oh, I don't think I have this, you know, take this diagnosis off me. I don't think I have it anymore, you know, in that kind of way. And so, but with the government, it's because they want you not to be, and because they're, you know, particularly is kind of, you know, so such a terrible process, and people, you know, are denied it so much and everything. It kind of makes you question it, and it makes you do that, and it makes you think, oh, I need to not, and I'm fine, and that it's exhausting.
It's so wild. Anyway, moving on from internalized ableism. So you say that you often don't feel queer enough.
Yeah, I'm getting better with that one, but it's kind of, I guess it's connected to that same kind of not feeling disabled enough and not feeling it's like I sort of identify as pansexual, really, or bisexual. I have done for like 25 years or something. I've married to another woman for 15 years now. I've been, thank you. I've been, you know, I've had the various struggles that have been associated with that in terms of, you know, family and everything. I now, you know, do drag, which is, you know, quite queer. But I still kind of sometimes, I think, well, because I'm not a lesbian, or, you know, I'm not trans, or I'm not, you know, I'm not, am I enough into that space? And I think it's that same with that kind of disabled. It's like, well, I'm disabled, but there are people who are more disabled than me. And so are there people who are maybe more queer than me? And therefore, have I got a right to it? And I am actually getting better at that and kind of going, well, actually, no, I do. And just because I look a little bit different, particularly, you know, like cis gay men who are kind of that very specific type of queer. It's like, well, I'm not that. I'm not really the lesbian kind of queer, but I am sometimes. I say I'm not, and I can hear my wife laughing in her head and going, yeah, I know you are. But not
amazing,
you know, maybe not enough. And it's that, yeah, it's the same kind of internalized isms yourself that
yeah. And there's no logic to that, because I literally couldn't argue against that on that, because obviously for me, when I literally look at your form, I'm like, yes, very queer, married, yeah, 18 years with a, yes, very, very definitely queer. But it's the internalized.
Yeah, whatever. And I'd definitely be, you know, in terms of like homophobia or whatever, no one would have a doubt there that it would be, you know, a victim of that. And I have had to have those fights, you know, like, you know, particularly with my daughter. I had a kind of thing with her school that was happening, you know, and I do, you know, straight people would not hesitate to label me as queer, in the same way as I guess, you know, able-bodied people wouldn't hesitate to label me as disabled. But I, you know, is that, have I actually got a right to that identity? And actually, identity isn't something you have a right to otherwise. It's just who you are. But I have to remind myself that a lot.
And you talk about being your own cup of tea in terms of your performing. Is that your, so it's like your identity and kind of being who you are and being your own cup of tea and doing what you enjoy, is that something that you kind of bring together for your performances?
It's really hard, because I think it does have to be a balance. There's a few Instagram polls recently actually about, you know, do you perform for yourself or do you perform for your audience, and like there isn't I reject the binary of that question, because I think you can't ignore the audience. And actually connecting with an audience is what is part of the joy of it. I, you know, when I first started, I actually expected that I would mostly be doing kind of digital kind of bedroom stuff, just because it's kind of hard to get out. But then, you know, been able to kind of get out and about and just kind of the joy back of kind of connecting with a live audience is like, oh, this is amazing. So you can't ignore the audience, but what you can do is you can kind of work out what certain audiences, what will go down better with certain audiences and still be able to kind of take risks and not end up kind of, this is what I'm really trying with, just not end up being a kind of copy of what someone else is doing, because that's kind of working for them. And I keep kind of pulling myself back to kind of like, why am I actually doing this? Because it's not for the money. I could, you know, I'm never going to be able to make a living out of doing this, and it's not, you know, so why am I doing it? And it's because I want to create certain things, or I want to make certain points, or experience a certain kind of joy, and I want to be the performer that I would like to see. That doesn't sound too narcissistic.
No, God, no, not at all.
Just in the sense of, you know, doing something different and being up there and either saying something different or just doing things a different way. And I guess that's what kind of what I mean by being my own cup of tea. It's like, well, that's what I would want to see, or at least what I'm trying to do there is what I would like to see. And not everyone will like it. And I kind of hope that not everyone will like it. I think if you have a show, like a drag show, if you've kind of got four people say on the bill and a host and everyone likes it fine, then it probably wasn't a great show. I feel like, you know, if a couple of people are not necessarily hating it, but thinking, oh, I didn't, that wasn't really my cup of tea, it's like, well, great, because that it's probably someone else going, that was brilliant, that was memorable, I'm going to remember that in you know, tomorrow morning, or, you know, once the Instagram videos have gone off the stories, I'm still going to remember, you know, as opposed to kind of something that's, you know, very good, but just not anything new and interesting. So I think you need to have, you know, I would love everyone in the audience to love what I'm doing. Of course I would. Like, you know, and give me Oscars and whatever awards and power me with money and praise and love. But like, obviously, but I think like that doesn't happen without some people not liking it. You know, it's nothing is universally popular. And so, you know, I'd rather be some people to really, really, really enjoy it. And then some people not, than just to be forgettable.
Yeah. Do you kind of perform for like the younger version of yourself?
Ooh, that's an interesting question. I don't really think so much about age. I sometimes very much do think about age, because I'm generally speaking, when I go into dressing room, I could have at least babysat most of the kids in the room, if not actually parented them, because, you know, the drag scene is quite a lot of young people, and I'm going to be 41 next month. And it's a really interesting thing actually about age, that people will, I've never been asked my age so much since like since I started doing drag. I think people don't tend to ask. And I don't know whether it's because younger people tend to ask or whether it's, I'm not sure what it is, but you know, people talk about it, people ask me, but I see this like in people's Instagram bios, like how old they are and stuff. And I just think, well, it's kind of not really relevant information necessarily to me. And people are often surprised, and it's an interesting kind of mix of like, I'm glad that you're surprised, because clearly your view of what it means to be 40 is not this. and so I'm kind of glad that I'm not clearly like an old fogey in the corner and everyone's thinking, oh God, you know, don't speak to them. They don't understand who, well, I don't even know what pop reference to make, because, you know, I don't get a lot of the references. So I'm glad that people don't see me as that. But on the other hand, oh my God, I'm glad I'm not 21. So, but people are surprised. I think once you're on the stage, like, I don't really know how old people are. Especially like, I'll see people out of drag and go, oh, you look like 10 years different, older or younger or something, you know, out of. And so kind of the age thing is kind of becomes kind of less relevant again, which is interesting, because I think in, you know, my life kind of out of drag, it's that thing of being a woman and you know, getting actually into menopause years, and you know, essentially you're done, you know, like, I hope you had a good life.
Yeah, bye.
yeah. And so actually, you know, because you don't get that so much and partly it's a queer spaces thing. Queer spaces being kind of less connected with the kind of breeding and when you're going to have children, all of that kind of, you know, possibly. But it's yeah, I feel like I don't feel so, yeah, kind of feel younger. And so I don't know. I feel younger. That suggests that it's better to be younger, which actually I don't think it is. But I feel less concerned by age, I guess, is more accurate.
I completely understand. My sister is, don't tell her I've forgotten what age, but she's early 60s. And I remember when she turned, you know, like 55, going up through the years, and people would say, oh my God, you don't look like a 55-year-old or a 60-year-old. And she's like, it's so weird. People think that, like, this is just who I am and what I look like at 60. It doesn't mean anything.
Yeah. Like, of course you look like a 60-year-old because you're 60. It's like, by definition, you look like a 60-year-old. And it's, yeah, it's a really odd kind of thing that I feel like partly I'm so enjoying drag so much that partly I think, oh, I wish I'd have done this 20 years ago. But then I think, well, I don't want to be 20 years ago. Now,
oh my God, no.
so, you know, maybe it's good that I'm doing it now that I'm a bit older and I've got some perspective. And
do you think it's,
you know, I'm kind of blessed.
More challenging coming to drag in your 30s and 40s?
I think it's a different challenge. I mean, obviously, I don't know, because I've not done both, but I think when I was kind of in my 20s, I mean, I hadn't yet become disabled for one thing, so you know, I would have been out more, I would have, you know, been able to be kind of more flexible with taking opportunities, you know, more stamina, like, you know, I still drank and I would have been out, and you know, I have no idea what happens like after half an hour after the end of a drag gig, because I go home. I drive home, I don't drink, everyone's drinking. Yeah. It's, you know, so you've got all of that. But on the other hand, I think being a bit older, I've got partly, you know, I'm sort of lucky enough to have a fair amount of financial stability. So I'm not panicking in terms of that. So there's that. There's just, I think, just a degree of pragmatism, or, you know, just life experience, I guess, without wanting to sound patronizing, because I think, you know, life experience is not necessarily chronological. Well, you know,
it. I think you can have, yeah. And that's why I think like the age is again an irrelevant thing, and it's life experience, physical capability, and those things have much more of a bearing on what
yeah.
experience is.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. so yeah. Does that That's your question. I know what your question was anymore. Sorry.
Sorry. I'm going to be honest with you. I've got no idea. My short-term memory is shot at the moment. So let's say yes. You answered it brilliantly.
Fantastic. It was such a good question as well. So, you know.
Thank you. I've got no idea what it was. That's great. This question, I do know what it is though, because it's a question that I ask all my guests. If you were a mythical creature, what would you be and why?
Okay. So I have thought about this possibly a little bit too much. because I've been listening to the podcast just to kind of make sure, you know, see what, and also because it's good, obviously, sorry. But in terms of kind of thing, so here's the thing, I'm not hugely into fantasy, which is I realize kind of quite unusual for kind of queer people and neurodivergent people, and I think it's quite,
but you're not
into fantasy. I'm not queer enough. Well, do you know what though? You're joking, but it's kind of one of those things that.
No, oh my God, no, I'm really joking. Points. I'm really joking.
No, I know you're joking. No, I know, but it is one of the things that I kind of go, well, that is a cultural kind of queer touch point, and I'm
so,
not really.
So like video games and Eurovision, and not everybody's into those, and like I can't even think. I don't know other stuff, other queer tropes.
I do love Eurovision.
We love Eurovision.
Beyonce, well. But
we're also like sword lesbians, but he's a man, so. It's fine.
but yeah, so fantasy, you know, it's just like I do love Buffy. I did grow up with Buffy.
Yes.
It's problematic, but you know, generally speaking, fantasy is not kind of my thing. So I was trying to think, you know, what to give like an authentic answer. rather than kind of so there's a Scottish nursery rhyme. It's called Three Crows Sat Upon a Wall, right? It's about three crows that are sitting on a wall. And I first came across it when my daughter was wee. And it's just a fairly basic nursery rhyme. So you've got three crows on a wall. The first crow was greeting for his maw, so he's crying for his mom. That's what crow one out of three was doing. Goes back to the chorus, three crows. Second one fell and broke his jaw, as that's crow two out of three. Mm-hmm. And then crow three, couldn't he call a tour, various different versions, but it's kind of crow three of three, and then it goes back to the verse, and then there's verse four, which is the fourth crow was neither a tour, which is like the fourth crow wasn't there.
Yeah,
because this is a song about three crows.
Yeah,
so of course the fourth crow wasn't there. Now I've always just admired this as a surreal work of genius. So like my daughter's a baby, and it's just like this is a brilliant song. This is like, it's so unexpected at the end. You kind of go on, then there's this other quote that like wasn't there. But
it's brilliant.
But that, I kind of then got thinking about kind of the way that history is told, and the way that queer people, neurodivergent people, disabled people are represented in history. And the fact that, you know, some people will say that certain identities are new, and that, you know, you did used to get kind of all these neurodivergent people, and you know, why are there suddenly trans people everywhere, or all this kind of thing, and because they're not really in the history books, but you know, the fact is that we did exist, and were either kind of locked away or just kind of made to mask and pretend ourselves didn't exist. Lots of fantasy stories about that, actually. So the old myth of the changeling child is supposedly, you know, to do with the autistic children. But the fact is people were just generally just kind of existing and, you know, having chats and all the rest of it, and just don't like the word normal. But kind of just being ordinary people in the world, and I think that's kind of, so this is why my answer to your question is that I'm kind of the fourth core in that story, because I'm not an ethereal being, I'm not a fantasy creature with superpowers, I'm not, you know, any of that. I'm just a person living my life that, you know, it's maybe not in the title. And suddenly the title is about someone else. And, you know, apparently that's not what the history of the world is about. But actually, you know, I and people like me, we're there as a fourth core, you know, whether or not we're in the title of the book. And doesn't mean we're not there.
I absolutely not the history of the world. Love that. That might be one of the best answers we've ever had on the podcast.
Thank you.
But I'm biased because I also really love crows.
Oh, well, there we go. It's yeah.
I know, that's pretty. Is it is it the National Trust or is it somebody else that's just put together Everywhere and Nowhere, which is about disabled people kind of obviously being everywhere throughout history, but this common misconception that we were nowhere and being left out of the conversation.
Yeah.
Oh,
I've God. Not heard of that, but yeah, it's that exact thing. It's you know, all of those types of identities that were not in kind of various history books and therefore didn't exist, but actually.
Yeah, there's someone somewhere saying, not in my day, we didn't have trans people and non-binary people and disabled people. Yeah, that is a wonderful answer, Himish. Thank you so much. Do you have any further words? You've dropped a lot of wisdom. Do you have any further words of wisdom for anyone who might be listening, anyone who's considering getting into drag or just in general?
I feel like I have to be very wise at the end. I don't know if I have been wise so far. The only thing I'd say is just do it. And it's okay to do it badly if you do it badly. And it's okay to do it badly to begin with. And it's, you know, try something, give it a go, because a life is short. And it's, you know, it is short and it's, you don't know what's going to happen around the next corner. And if you want to try something. And, yeah, anyone can always drop me a message as well on Instagram or whatever, if you want to chat about specifically kind of navigating, you know, disabled drag. Please, my kind of DMs are open so we can support each other as a community.
That is fantastic. And do you have any upcoming performances to promote?
So I do have a gig down in London in March. I don't know whether they get out of Scotland. It hasn't been announced yet, so I don't know when it's being announced. I don't know that it will have been announced yet. But if you are someone in London who would, and I realise London's quite big, but you can look out for that one.
I tell you what I'll do. I'll keep an eye out, and also if you keep an eye out, and then you let me know as soon as it's released, and I'll add it and then promote it as well. So that people can
okay. All right, brilliant.
In the description of this podcast, hopefully.
Okay.
If not, good luck to you. I mean, just keep checking Himish's social media, which will also be in the description of this podcast. Fabulous.
Yeah.
Okay.
I announce things as they are allowed to be announced. I've got a few things coming up, but none of them are announced yet, so I can't say what I'm doing, but yeah.
Oh my god, yeah,
I will update you.
You just gotta like keep all the secrets.
No, it's hard work.
I know. No, I'm in the same position. I'm sitting on something large. That sounded really I'm gonna end this podcast before I say anything else towards one of the most fabulous drag kings. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been brilliant.